You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm broadcasting from the Chicago suburbs, where snow fell earlier. A few suburbs north of me, there was even more snow. I was up there earlier this morning, and I couldn't believe, well, they talked about it yesterday, but it was 62 yesterday, and it was hard to believe that it could change so drastically. Anyway, I'm really happy that you've joined me today, and at republicbroadcasting.org, I highly recommend that you also visit and subscribe to SpingolaSpeaks.net and ScreeningSandyHook.net. I invite you to visit our chat room, and that is located at spingola.chatango.com. If you wish to review the names of the guests that I've had the pleasure of interviewing on this program, simply visit spingola.com, click on the radio schedule button on the left, and choose the appropriate year, month, and you will see links to the guest websites. You will see other links that have relevant information. And you can go back all the way to 2010 to see who I've had on the program. And I've had the pleasure, the honor of having so many people on the program that have brought us so much wonderful, wonderful information. And that is also the case today. Our guest for the first 2 hours today is Roman Bistrionic, and he is a co-author with Dr. Suzanne Humphreys of Dissolving Illusions, Disease, Vaccines, and the Forgotten History. And the website of interest is dissolvingillusions.com. Roman, welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, you?
Good, it's not so nice here today as well. It got very cold, cloudy, not so nice. But, that's the way it goes.
Exactly. Yeah, it's kind of different. We haven't talked for a while, but things really have not changed except the clamor, particularly lately, for more vaccines and more often. And the one that seems to be hitting the news recently is that is measles. And if you haven't had a measles vaccination recently, then boy, run into your doctor and beg him or her to give you a vaccine so that you can avoid this horrible, horrible, horrible disease that is sure to make you incredibly ill or even kill you.
Yeah, I know. That's in the news now. This happened a number of years ago. We had outbreaks, and so the same thing kind of happened then. So anytime there is a spike in the measles cases, this is going to happen. And that's kind of what I really put together a talk about. And I really want to talk about, things you probably wouldn't read in articles or hear, mostly on the radio or television. And those are usually very limited in their perspectives, you know, on, especially on the TV, and in articles. I haven't really kept up that much with what's been going on because I've been doing other things, but certainly there's a lot of articles about measles now and what you should do. There also seems to be an anger that permeates the coverage and a panic about the disease spreading and what that could mean. And I believe the anger comes from fear, and that fear comes from a lack of knowledge. So So what I would like to talk about is some history and information that is not well known, and I hope it will put things in perspective and alleviate some of that anxiety. I'd like to use direct quotes from historical and scientific books and journals, and I think when you hear some of those and we talk about some of the data, what the history was really like and what the science was saying back then and is saying, then, you know, you can decrease some of that anxiety.
Right.
If anyone wants these references and the quotes, you can email me or, I don't know, can we post these on the website or?
Absolutely.
All right, great. So you can either email me at romanbistrianik@gmail.com and I'll send them to you. I think everyone should do their own research. And so this will give you a leg up and then you can, make decisions based on information. That takes time. I spent a lot of time doing this in the past. But if you just rely on what other people are saying, you're not really making an informed choice, in my opinion. I won't be able to talk about everything about, you know, this topic, but what I really want to do is give people a flavor of, the history of what happened over time, what was life like in the 1800s, and what things changed to give us, you know, the world we live in today. So I'll just keep going. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So before our modern times, there were a lot of infectious diseases in Europe and in the Americas. At different times, people died in huge numbers from these diseases. And there was a bunch of them. There was typhoid, typhus, scarlet fever, diphtheria, whooping cough, tuberculosis, that was a big killer. That was actually referred to as consumption back then because the way it wasted away and consumed its victims. Pneumonia, influenza, smallpox, and measles, they were all big killers. Measles is a viral infection. A lot of the other ones were bacterial, except for smallpox. And like many diseases, it resulted in lots of deaths over different decades. And so this article is from the New York Times, January 19, 1908. It's called Measles Kills 1463 Children. And it says, the startling mortality among children from the little-regarded ailment of measles was indicated today by a statement issued by the State Department of Health, showing that in 1906, there were 1,463 deaths from it, 1,240 being children under the age of 5. In December alone, 2,807 cases of the disease were reported, and a search of the records shows that it kills 2.5 times more children than does scarlet fever. Another article, Vitamin A and Measles from Nutrition Reviews, Volume 58, Number 2, February 2000, page S46. And it goes, measles accounted for 11% of all deaths in Glasgow in the year 1807 to 1812. Case fatality rates were high. For example, during the years 1867 to 1872 in a Paris orphanage, 612 of 1,256, that's 49%, of children who developed measles died.
Wow.
Yeah. So looking at the death, also known as mortality statistics, so you can see, and I put these charts together based on all this data, and you can find them on dissolvingillusions.com /graphs. Now, during the 1800s and even into the early 1900s, measles was a big killer. So that's historically accurate. England was in the forefront of documenting mortality statistics and began gathering them in 1838. From 1838 until the year about 1900, death rates from measles oscillated up and down and reached around 60 to 70 per 100,000. Or 600 to 700 in a million. These type of statistics really are represented by a number X per 100,000, where the number of deaths have been normalized based on population. You want to do that so you can compare from year to year, no matter what the population is, so you have a, you know, standard comparison. Then starting around the year 1900, there was a steady decline in deaths from measles, which reached a low of 0.1 to 0.3 per 100,000 by the 1960s. Or in other words, one to three in a million. So from that high of 600 to 700 in a million, it was a decrease of over 99%, close to 100%. So the actual change is from 99.5 to 99.86%. That's obviously a gigantic decline.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And your graphs are wonderful. I've studied those graphs, looked at them, and of course those are available at dissolvingillusions.com, and I will post that link in the chat room.
Thank you.
Yeah, the graphs
are those
incredible.
Are
incredible.
Great. Yeah, they're full color, and when we put it in the book, they're, you know, kind of black and white. Not so nice looking. But yeah, you can look at these, examine them, and make your own conclusions from them. But you know, the data is pretty clear from multiple countries that, you know, the mortality rate had declined tremendously. And you know, we can read articles that people were talking about from really the early 1900s on about this happening as they were experiencing it. And so I'd like to read some of those. This is from the Berkeley Daily Gazette, December 27th, 1935. All of the old menaces like typhoid, smallpox, measles, scarlet fever, whooping cough, and diphtheria have become minor causes of death. The chance is very remote indeed that any of them will ever again assume sufficient importance in the mortality tables seriously to affect the general death rate. That's in 1935. Here's an article from American Journal of Infection Control, August 2001, page 204. And the article is Personal Hygiene and Life Expectancy Improvements Since 1850. And the quote is, between 1815 and 1900, the commonly recurring epidemics of cholera, smallpox, malaria, and typhoid were gradually brought under control. During the next 50 years, gratifying victories over such endemic diseases as tuberculosis, diphtheria, measles, and scarlet fever were witnessed. These diseases were less dramatic than epidemics, but each was among the leading causes of death before 1900. By the middle of the 20th century, except for the 1918 influenza pandemic, death from infectious diseases in Western industrial countries was no longer a major component of mortality statistics. Yeah, I have a whole bunch of quotes. I don't know if I should really read through all of them. But I want to read this one. Okay, this is from Vital Statistics, British Medical Journal, February 7th, 1959, page 381. In the majority of children, the whole episode has been well over, truly over in a week. In this practice, measles is considered a relatively mild and inevitable childhood ailment that is best encountered any time from 3 to 7 years of age. Over the past 10 years, there have been few serious complications at any age, and all children have made complete recoveries. That's over 10 years. As a result of this reasoning, no special attempts have been made at prevention, even in young infants in whom the disease has not been found to be especially serious.
Wow.
And one more. This is the British Medical Journal, July 11th. 1964, pages 72 to 73. This is measles and measles vaccination. Death from measles in Britain is now unusual. Furthermore, in one half of the deaths, there was an accompanying chronic disease or disability, which in the majority was described as a serious handicap. It is reasonable, therefore, to conclude that in the past 30 years, mortality from measles has been reduced to virtually the lowest figure possible. So what all these articles and the data shows that measles and other infectious diseases, that was once a huge and horrible problem slowly became much less deadly, and that by the early 1960s was really not a huge cause of concern. You can even find a 1960 episode of the Brady Bunch on YouTube about everyone in the family getting measles. And there was no panic or fear, but only a reaction to something that everyone just went through without any real problems, just as discussed in that 1959 British Medical Journal article where they said it was a relatively mild and an inevitable childhood ailment. So that's what measles was like. It was a big killer by the 1950s, 1960s. Wasn't much of a problem, was considered, a minor problem.
And there were reasons for the outbreaks and for the difference in the way that it affects the body. And you address this in the book, and it's also on the website, that by having a clean environment, clean water, fresh air, good food, 100 people not using the same restroom facilities, that it really didn't become that dangerous. And as you said, it's a childhood disease, that typically when a child gets something, the immune system kicks in and that system becomes stronger. If a tree, a palm tree particularly, does not have the resistance and get strong from the wind, then it would not be able to grow and endure and to later withstand 100-mile winds. The immune system, in order to become stronger, needs to have something to help it along. Correct? I'm probably as well as you would.
No. Well, I mean, if you're already in a compromised situation where you're, don't have a strong immune system because you're being overworked, you're tired, you're eating, poisoned food, essentially, you just aren't nutritionally supported, then when you encounter something like that, your body just doesn't have a chance. And I think that's what was going on back then. And there was a lot of things that were really pretty horrible in the 1800s. It wasn't this romantic, people on top hats walking down the street with ladies with long flowing gowns, people having leisurely trips down the river on paddle wheel river boats. That wasn't really the norm. Life was actually very brutal, very difficult and deadly for a lot of people. There were, people working 12 to 16 hours a day in really horrible conditions. Children were, basically let loose. They didn't have parents to watch them. Their parents were, overworked. They didn't have time for that. Children were working in factories and in mines as young as 4 years old.
So,
things were not what they, are today. There were no labor laws, child labor laws. Houses were an abomination and often deadly. Food was poor nutrition at best, rotten or even deadly. There was no concept of sanitation or hygiene. There was no fresh water or clean places to go to the bathroom.
And it was running in the street, right?
Right. Well, if you have no bathroom, it has to go out the window. If you have a window. Many places didn't have windows. So it was extremely difficult. It was horrifying. And I could read some quotes from various publications about that, if you like. And it's just, when you read some of this stuff, it's hard to imagine. And I think the closest parallel is if you look at some of the poorest places on the planet now, where people are in shanty towns and they don't have running water or good food, that's the kind of conditions that were largely there.
Right. Wow.
I hear music, so I guess
yes.
We're breaking.
All righty. We are going to a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back.
Starts with you and me. Starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead. To change the bad to good. To live in harmony. It starts with you.
All right, welcome back. Our guest first 2 hours today is Roman Bistriani. He is the author, the co-author with Dr. Suzanne Humphreys of Dissolving Illusions, Disease, Vaccines, and the Forgotten History. The website is dissolvingillusions.com. All righty. We were talking about real life and how things really were. And it's,
yeah, so we're quite lucky we don't live like that. Well, there are people that live like that today.
Right.
But in the Western world, that's been transformed. I can read a couple of quotes. I have quite a few. I can't go through them all. But so this is from Civilization and Disease, 1943, pages 38 to 39. The stenches from the horrible foul cellars and their infernal system of sewage must needs poison the tenants all the way up to the fifth story, the well-worn rut of the dead wagon and the ambulance to the gate, for the tenants died there like flies in all seasons, and a tenth of its population was always in hospital. This is from Jacob Riis, The Battle of the Slum, 1902, pages 22, 23 to 25. The Tenement House Commission long afterward called the worst of the barracks infant slaughterhouses and showed by reference to the mortality list that they killed one in every five babies born in them. So, you know, these were horrible.
Wow.
Really just hard to imagine. Let's see. This is The Greatest Benefit to Mankind, 1997, page 399. For millions entire lives, albeit very short ones, were passed into the new industrial cities of dreadful night with an all-too-typical sociopathology. Foul housing, often in flooded cellars, gross overcrowding, atmospheric and water supply pollution, overflowing cesspools, contaminated. Yeah, poverty, hunger, fatigue, and abjection everywhere. Such conditions comparable to today's third-world shantytown or refugee camps, right, rampant disease, rampant sickness of every kind. Appalling neonatal infant and child mortality accompanied the abomination of child labor in mines and factories. Life expectations were exceedingly low, often under 20 years among the working classes. And everywhere, sickness precipitated family breakdown, pauperization, and social crisis. So that does not paint a pretty picture in any regards.
Right.
Here's another, let's see. Okay. So, this is from, Western Civilization Beyond Boundaries, volume 2, 2010, page 279. In manufacturing towns, factory chimneys spewed soot and everything was covered with dirt and grime. Smoke was a major ingredient of the famous London fog, which, by the way, wasn't really a fog. It was all the soot, which not only reduced visibility but posed serious health risks. Refuse, including the rotting corpses of dogs and horses, littered the streets. In 1858, the stench from sewage and other rot in London was so putrid that the British House of Commons was forced to suspend its sessions. See, this is another one, The Irrepressible Conflict, 1850 to 1865, 1934 was published, page 181. Milk sold in Chicago came from cows fed on whiskey slops and their bodies covered with sores and tails all ate off.
Ugh.
A circumstance which enabled the editorial critic to explain why so many children die in Chicago. New York's milk supply was also largely a byproduct of the local distilleries, and the milk dealers were charged with a serious offense of murdering annually 8,000 children. So that was, you know, the food was just an abomination. There was no refrigeration, of course, so and people just weren't clean, so you were going to pay and pass diseases all over the place. Let's see, one more. This is from Child Labor, American Economic Association, March 1890, page 16. Children of all ages down to 3 or 4 were found in the hardest and most painful labor, while babes of 6 were commonly found in a large number of many factories. Labor from 12 to 13 and often 16 hours a day was the rule. Children had not a moment free, save to snatch a hasty meal or sleep as best they could. From earliest youth, they worked to point of extreme exhaustion without open-air exercise or any enjoyment whatever, but grew up, if they survived at all, weak, bloodless, miserable, and in many cases deformed cripples and victims of almost every disease. So
that is not a pretty picture.
No, life was during the times before the Western world was transformed. It was just horrifying and resulted in short life expectancy and diseases that killed millions.
Wow. All righty, we're going to a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back.
It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me.
All righty, welcome back. Our guest today is Roman Bistrionic. He is the co-author with Dr. Suzanne Humphreys of Dissolving Illusions, Disease, Vaccines, and the Forgotten History. And the website is dissolvingillusions.com. Of course, many of us had ancestors that experienced some of the same things that you're talking about. And it's, I guess we ought to be all thankful that we're here, and that don't live under such horrific circumstances that our ancestors survived. And, and people don't understand, they just don't have the frame of reference to understand or to do the research that you have done.
So when I started, doing his research and I dug into books at the library, no, I didn't know. How would you know? Not something you're typically taught. You're taught, kind of standard history, not this kind of stuff. And so, it definitely blew me away, and that's really what made me want to decide to work on a book. That wasn't my first goal. I was just reading and reading and reading, and I was always fascinated with history and science, so that's how this all started.
Thank goodness for that and for your curiosity, because as you say, people don't know what they don't know. And to listen to the programming on television, that's kind of what they go by. And it's
it's usually quite limited, right? It's limited. I mean, there's good programs, but there's a lot of garbage. Now we saw the deaths were high and then they went down. We know that life was horrible in the 1800s for a lot of people. There were people that were well off and they lived, good lives, but a lot of people didn't. So what happened was really a sanitary revolution, health revolution. And that started in the 1850s, and it was a lot of people, social activists, prison reformers, physicians, clergy, scientists, all came together over many decades to really put this all together. So there was a lot of work, and a lot of that was lost in the pages of history. Nobody really knows about all these sacrifices that a lot of people made to make life possible the way it is today. quote. Let's see, where's a good one? Right, so this is from American Journal of Infection Control, August 2001, page 205. This sanitary movement was instrumental in getting legislation passed in Great Britain during the 1850s and 1860s to create public health authorities with the power to regulate sewage collection, water supply, environmental nuisances, and a remarkable list of other relevant matters such as physician licensing and child labor abuses. Yeah, I don't want to go through all these things. There's just too many. Otherwise, we're running out of time. Okay, just one more. This is from Medical Brief, 1907, pages 42 to 43. Accordingly, the present generation is beginning to learn that and will realize more thoroughly as time wears on, the fantastic idea with regard to contagious and infectious disease is absolutely erroneous, and the many so-called unavoidable diseases are positively preventable. It is not true each individual must run the gamut of measles, scarlet fever, whooping cough, diphtheria, tuberculosis, and like. If proper precautionary measures be taken on the outset, sunshine, fresh air, wholesome nutrition, exercise, rest, and hygienic mode of living are far more effective than all the subsequent medication in existence. Wow. That was by Charles E. Page, M.D.
Right.
There are people that realized that these things made a difference. Plumbing, hygiene, nutrition, pasteurization. Later on, electricity came in. Refrigeration started out with ice boxes and then changed to refrigerators. Housing standards, labor laws, child labor laws. All these things together is really, you know, made a critical difference. That's what transformed everything. I'm afraid I'm going to run out of time to cover everything, but,
we've got like 20 minutes during this period.
Sure. Right. So now we'll come to the actual vaccine, which, in the United States was introduced in 1963. So that by that point, you had a 98% decrease in mortality from the statistics. In England, because they began the statistics earlier in 1838, you again can see the high death rate and it plummets down, and they began vaccinating in 1968, and again, the death rate was down by really over about 100%. And what to me was what I found interesting is none of this was ever covered in any of the medical literature that I ever found. yeah, so.
I wonder why. That's
well, I looked, but I haven't looked recently, but I looked for quite a few years and I did find one article that showed measles death and incidence decline, but the goal was an article talking about measles vaccine. So the, you know, it wasn't really talked about. There was no discussion about why there was a decline before the vaccine. They talked about after the vaccine. And, which really was, I think, a tragedy because there was no lessons learned. Why did you have such a massive decline in death rate? And instead, you know, the focus became on the vaccine and not as a more holistic, you know, what can we do to really take care of this problem and maybe not even use a vaccine. But that became the focus over time, and it's been that kind of thing ever since.
Now, the information is not readily made available, and we seem to have people in the news, I guess it's, Big Pharma, who are pushing vaccines, and what could be contributory to the children who are getting the measles now and allegedly dying from the measles? Is it compromised immune systems? And could that be from vaccines?
Well, well, here's one of the things that wasn't really talked about or explored a lot, and that is nutrition. And there were articles in the scientific literature talking about reduction of rates of mortality with vitamin A, for example. And here's an article on vitamin A supplementation and child mortality, a meta-analysis. This is in the Journal of the American Medical Association, February 17th, 1993, page 901. Combined analysis show that a massive doses of vitamin A given to patients hospitalized with measles were associated with approximately 60% reduction of risk of death overall and with an approximate 90% reduction among infants. So there's articles in the literature about that. There's also articles on vitamin C treatment, and this is from a doctor, Fred Klenner, Southern Medical and Surgery Journal, July 1949. During an epidemic of measles, vitamin C was used prophylactically, and all those who received as much as 1,000 milligrams every 6 hours by vein or muscle were protected from the virus. Given by mouth, 1,000 milligrams in fruit juice every 2 hours was not protective unless it was given around the clock. It was also further found that 1,000 milligrams by mouth 4 to 6 times each day would modify the attack with the appearance of spots and fever. If the administration was increased to 12 doses every 24 hours, all signs and symptoms would disappear in 48 hours. So he discovered through his experiments with children that, you know, in his case, vitamin C could be just tremendous if you had measles. So, you know, you can help your child by following that type of protocol. And I think it's kind of, you know, it's a real tragedy that this information is never shared by anybody. So if your child is sick with measles, you know, either you didn't vaccinate or maybe you had a vaccine failure, these strategies could help a lot of people, and they can get through, you know, a disease much easier if they knew about this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, nutrition is, you know, the key.
Now, does the vaccine, the MMR, which is measles, mumps, and rubella, does it have the live virus in them? Of these three?
I believe so, but no, I really don't know for sure. I haven't really kept up with vaccine information the last 5 years,
right.
So I've been busy with what our next topic will be. But,
Hillman really, he developed this vaccine and Merck licensed it. And I think if you look in the ingredients, you see that it's very questionable. Aluminum and MFA.
Well, there's certainly aluminum and other ingredients in there. And, you know, I'm not going to speak to that right now because I haven't really kept up with that. But what is interesting is that one of the things that used to happen in the 50s and 60s, if you got measles, which you typically got when you were, you know, a child, you know, 3 to 6, 7 years old, is you would get it, usually mild, usually not a problem, very often, you know, kind of a standard childhood illness. And then you were immune for life. But that was a different type of environment. There was always measles in the air, basically. So you're being re-exposed your whole life. So you're always getting what they call natural boosting.
Mm-hmm.
The vaccine does provide pretty good protection so that when you get it, you're not going to get measles too easily. And that's the reason, you know, the incidence has decreased greatly after they introduced the vaccine. But one of the problems is that the vaccine immunity wanes over time. So it's not a, you know, permanent solution. So what happens is over time you get what they call secondary vaccine failure that can basically what it means is that the vaccine wears off. So then you get decreased immunity, which wouldn't have happened in the pre-vaccine era. And the problem with that is, here's an article. This is from the Proceedings of the Royal Society B. Implications of vaccination and waning immunity. This is in 2009. We can foresee that vaccination will have two conflicting effects. It will reduce the number of newborn susceptibles and hence should have some of the usual associated public health benefits, reducing the number of cases in young children. However, this reduction in cases will lead to a reduction in boosting and therefore a greater susceptibility to infection in older classes. When immunity wanes, vaccination has far more limited impact on the average number of cases. While the observation has clear public health implications, the dynamic consequences that interaction between vaccination, waning immunity, and boosting are far more striking. For high levels of vaccination, greater than 80%, and moderate levels of waning immunity, greater than 30 years, large-scale epidemic cycles can be induced. So, you know, what we're saying here is that over many decades, the potential is that your immunity wanes, and because of that, you start having a more susceptible population, and then you have, you know, greater epidemics breaking out.
Wow.
So while the vaccine was quite successful in reducing incidence, which was, you know, kind of the goal. Actually, they thought they were going to eliminate it back in 1967. But, it has been successful doing that, but there's the other end of it that's not generally talked about. What happens when the vaccine becomes, wears off? The other thing is that, maternal antibodies in the pre-vaccine era, mothers would transmit their immunity to their children through placenta and through breast milk. And so children were, babies were protected until they were, their immune system was sufficient to handle something like a measles. But now, because mothers aren't naturally infected with measles, they provide a weaker immunity to their children. And so this is from the Oxford Textbook of Medicine, 2005, page 357. Waning immunity may become an increasing problem as vaccine coverage increases because more mothers will have been vaccinated. And since they have not been exposed or had natural measles, they will transmit lower levels of maternal antibody. Thus, their babies become susceptible to measles by 3 to 5 months of age.
Okay,
So whereas before you would have got measles when you were older and able to handle it, what could happen over time is weaker immunity is transmitted to your babies, and now they're susceptible at a younger age when they can't handle it.
Okay, so answers that question. Why there's more deaths now, and also a lot of women breastfeeding, and a lot of women are also having C-sections unnecessarily, so they miss going through the birth canal. Oh gosh, what a sad state of affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Alrighty, we are going to
a quick
3-minute break, and the next topic that you're going to talk about is incredibly interesting and of great interest to me and a lot of other folks. So stay with us. We'll be right back. All right, we are back with our guest, Roman Bystrianik, and he has another topic of interest that he began looking at. And it's something that we should all be concerned about, that we're going to talk about in the next hour. Give us a little preview.
I've been looking into the environment for about, a number of years. And there's a lot of serious problems that we're facing as a, not only as a country, but as a planet. And, I'll talk about that. It's a very difficult topic to talk about, actually, but, we'll talk about that next hour. I did want to wrap up a couple of things, in regard to measles is that, even in the 60s, there were people knew that, you know, we always talk about antibodies as a measure of immunity. That was not necessary for recovery from measles. You could get, there are people with conditions that they don't have any antibodies and they contract measles just in the normal way and they're immune too. So it's, there's a lot more to the story than, I think we've, you know, kind of thought there was. I want, you know, I think this is important. Measles is a very contagious disease, you know, and everyone should understand that. And if you vaccinate or not, you should be, you should act in a responsible way because the young children that are too young to have protection that would have been protected before the pre-vaccine era are now susceptible. So they're at risk and so are immune compromised people. So, you know, you have to act in a, you know, responsible way. So you might have to, you know, consider quarantining your family if there's an outbreak. You should probably research vitamin A, vitamin C, especially if you have children. And, you know, everybody has their own situation. So, but people should really, you know, kind of dig into it and, you know, do the research. And, but, you know, understand that you're not living in isolation, that we live in a, you know, global community that, you know, your, you know, decisions have consequences too. So I just want to make sure that, you know, people act responsibly, which I think a lot of people do, but you know, it's not just, oh, I don't want a vaccine and then just kind of drop the ball on it. You know, you have to know, you know, what the consequences are and what you need to do.
Right. Well, thank you. I think that, you've really done the research on this and, as I mentioned before, people should visit dissolvingillusions.com. Look at the charts. Share those charts with your friends. Share the website with your friends. And, I'm sure that, that they will be, very well educated for having
sure, visited. And email me I'll send you, well, I didn't read all the quotes, didn't have time. I'll send you all the quotes that have the references too, so you can get a leg up on that.
Sure. Yeah, just send me whatever links you would like, and I will put them up on the schedule page so that people can look at them. All righty, we're at the top of the hour. We will be right back.
Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth. Truth.
All right, welcome back. This is Leanna, and our guest is Roman Bistrianic. He is the co-author with Dr. Suzanne Humphreys of Dissolving Illusions, excuse me, Disease, Vaccines, and the Forgotten History. But this hour, we're going to be talking about something else. And then the third hour, we leave for call-ins and to talk about other things of interest to the listeners. Anyway, you are working on something else that I think is really imperative that people should consider. And that is, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No. the destruction of the planet. You were talking earlier about how things were terrible, sewage running in the streets, the clean, dirty water, and all those other things. And it seems now that we are reverting by all the trash and all the things that we are doing to destroy the ecosystem, to destroy the birds, the flowers, the bees that pollinate the fruits and vegetables. I am really concerned. We're spreading poison. We're trying to kill some mosquitoes. A mosquito bite is not going to hurt anybody. But all this poison that they're spewing out in the spring and the summer, it just makes me crazy to think about what they're doing to the ecosystem.
This was a number of years ago. I was working on the smallpox book, actually, and it was really interested in that, and I had lots of cool data from the 1500s to the 1800s and all that. But I was always kind of reading a lot of history, a lot of science, watching documentaries, listening to radio programs about different topics along those lines. And I had listened to one radio program where a scientist was talking about abrupt climate change and it's a notion of feedback loops, such as a giant methane release from the warming Arctic would increase global temperatures, rapidly. And he pictured, he painted a very bleak picture. And, after I listened to that, I was, honestly quite depressed. I spent a few days, just trying to get through that. And then I decided, I have to drop all these other things. I shelved the smallpox book, and I decided to do a deep dive into different environmental issues that I kind of knew about, but never, really paid that much attention to. So I started assembling chapters. That's how I like to organize my thinking. And that's changed over time, the different topics. But what I found, and everything I looked into, was always a lot worse than I even thought. And it's a difficult thing to kind of go through and really, if anybody's listening that is not emotionally stable or you suffer from depression, I really prefer you don't listen to this, because it's very disturbing. It's very terrifying and depressing. And I don't want anybody to go into a tailspin. On the other hand, I think everybody should be aware of a lot of this stuff, and even though it's horrifying information, so we can all be aware, take actions where we can, and the depression, fear, anxiety that comes along with all this is not fun, but it gets you to, act and think and act, and, start being aware of what's going on. And that's what happened to me. I, put a lot of things on the side, and I changed a lot of my lifestyle to, try to, mitigate damage through the different things that I'd like to be talking about and coming up next. I have preliminary chapters. I've written like about 10 of them. And I have a different email for this project, and it's called movingbackfrommidnight @gmail.com. I don't have a website yet, but I will be happily sending out chapters for anybody who wants them. And they're all fully referenced. So I have a chapter, for example, on plastics in the oceans, and that has like over 120 references about. It's not a long read. It's about 14 pages. But it's, there's a lot of information. There's a lot of things going on, and all these things, I think, are occurring at the same time. And the, you know, we're in serious danger of destroying a lot of life on the planet, including ourselves. And if it was one of these things, it would be horrible. But then we have all these different things occurring at the same time. And, you know, it's kind of a cliche, but the perfect storm is upon us, I think.
Right.
And
now you said that movingbackfrommidnight.com?
Well, no, there's no website. It's movingbackfrommidnight, all one word, at gmail.com.
Oh, is, Gmail. Okay.
My email, yeah. I don't have a website yet. I haven't had the time or anybody to help me with that. So I don't have one yet. As soon as I have that, all the chapters will be up online for free. I'm not in this to make money because this is a lot more important than, you know, a buck. So as soon as anybody wants chapters, I'll email them out. And some of the issues that we're facing is plastics are contaminating and destroying life in the oceans. We're also overfishing the oceans to such a horrible degree that we're in danger of wiping out fish stocks across the planet. Coral reefs across the globe are dying. Oceans are warming up, acidifying, and losing oxygen. Species are across the planet are declining and going extinct. Even, you know, your iconic animals like lions and giraffes and rhinos and tigers, they're all in population decline.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the insects. They're all there's insects declining across the planet.
And birds. As a child, there were all kinds of species of birds. You could go out, and they were all around. There were all these butterflies all around and hummingbirds. Yep. And now I see robins, and I see cardinals, and blackbirds, but
depending on your location, which species has declined, a lot of the species have declined. Birds, bats, all sorts of animals. So it depends on where you are. So a lot of things have declined. The Amazon rainforest is being deforested, as well as other rainforests across the planet. And the Amazon rainforest is close to a tipping point where it will spiral into out of control and just turn into at least large parts of it into savanna or even desert, which will have global implications. And we're really close to that tipping point, according to scientists. Glaciers across the planet are retreating. They're literally just evaporating. You have the Greenland, the Arctic, and Antarctica are melting at different rates at different times. And, you know, the permafrost is melting in Alaska and Siberia. And that threatens to release huge amounts of methane, which would cause, obviously huge problems.
Now you mentioned that we need to do something about it. isn't it the big corporations, the people who are after the resources, who are doing the damage to the planet, who are plowing down the rainforest to get after whatever it is they're going after? And individually, we can alter our own lives, eliminate plastics and aluminum and all that kind of thing. But how do you go after these big corporations who are just money hungry and they don't give a darn about what they're doing to the system?
Well, that's not, you know, obviously not an easy problem to solve. My take is that we take personal responsibility and really modify our lifestyles so that we're not having that impact. I mean, as a society, as a planet, we waste massive amounts of food. We consume these disposable pieces of clothing at, you know, ridiculous rates. We waste so much. We consume endless numbers of people shifted that ideology from that we're just these consuming entities instead of human beings, then, you know, that would have an impact. Because a lot of what drives deforestation is, you know, human beings' desire for special hardwoods from the rainforest, or they want cheap beef, because beef is one of the primary reasons the Amazon's being deforested and has been for a while, because they can get cheap beef. You know, all these kinds of things, you know, the palm oil, that's another reason, you know, forests are being hacked down. So, you know, if you change your behavior so you're not doing that, the more people that do that, the less, you know, there's an incentive to do get that stuff. Gold mining in the Amazon is a big issue, because people go in there and they hack down the forest to get at the gold. And at the same time, they're extracting the gold using mercury, which ends up into the environment. It poisons them. It poisons the water. And, you know, it's about a third of the mercury in the world that's being dumped in the environment is because of gold extraction. So, you know, using gold, different cultures use, you know, lots and lots of gold ornamentation. That really should stop. You don't need gold to be happy. It doesn't, you know, these kind of behaviors are what needs to change. It's a really radical kind of shift in human behavior. And all the while, the human population is continuing to increase, and we're going to hit 10 billion probably by 50. And that's a big problem, because resources keep on being decimated at really a breakneck speed.
And it's really the consumerism that is a problem. And we can each alter our lifestyles to be responsible for ourselves. And the planet, I believe, could accommodate the population if the population were not so intent on having all the latest gadgets and things that they really don't need. If you think about it, all of the electronic gadgets that we have, and now 5G is coming along, and you have a lot of things that, do we really need these things? I don't think so. And the plastic.
Generally, we don't need a lot. Sorry, go ahead. So generally, we don't need a lot of these things. And sure, you could accommodate a huge number of people on the planet, which we are currently doing, but the cost is tremendous. It's already tremendous. With the oceans being ravaged for food, you know, the overfishing is just way out of control. And at this point, 90% of the oceans are either overfished or at maximum. And so you only have 10% that's not being overly taxed. That's not a lot. So you have the life in the oceans being just basically, you know, ripped apart by these massive global fishing trawlers that go around, because everybody wants their seafood. Everybody wants tuna. They want whatever fish they can get. And that's devastating. There's going to be a point where, it may be by mid-century, 2050, that just based on that all the fish in the ocean could collapse.
Wow.
So there won't be these fish in the ocean. Then what are we going to do? So we need to really stop doing these kind of activities. And I, you know, I no longer eat anything from the ocean. There are people that subsist on, you know, like, things from the ocean, you know, local peoples. But in general, it's not a good idea. It's not sustainable.
Right. I think people should eat, what foods are readily available in their own locality, because that's natural to where they live. And if you live in the middle of the United States, you're not near enough, you know, you have the Great Lakes and whatnot. But if it's not local to your vicinity, then you probably shouldn't try to consume it. Now, when you were talking about cultures that place a lot of emphasis on gold, are you talking over and above, say, a wedding ring or?
Sure. I mean, you could look at the Indian culture. Their culture is particularly big on, you know, lots and lots excessive amount of gold. But there's, you know, other people use tons of gold, different categories of people think it's great to, you know, wear lots of gold chains and whatnot. But, you know, that's simply not, you know, something that people generally need. The reason we have so much, or one of the reasons we have so much mercury in our fish is because, you know, this insatiable desire for gold, which is something that's been going on for centuries, of course, but,
right, and it can't be good for the fish either to have to be full of ethyl mercury, which then we consume.
Right. Yeah, sure. And then we're of course overfishing them to the point where they can't keep up with our
reproduce. Right.
And that happened, you know, over many centuries. So when the Europeans first got to the Americas, the cod were tremendous all over the coast of New England, right? Up to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
They were described as being 6 to 7 feet long, 200 pounds, and there were so many cod that you just had to drop your hook in the water and pick it up. It was, you know, it was what drove the economy of New England for several hundred years. But then that's collapsed. By 1992, I think it was, the whole cod stocks collapsed because of massive overfishing. Same thing with salmon. Salmon was in all the rivers of New England. Mm-hmm. Now most of them are, you know, don't have any salmon left, and salmon stocks have collapsed. Fish stocks are collapsing across the planet, mm-hmm. and it's only a matter of time before the whole thing, like a house of cards, falls apart. On top of that is, again, back to the plastics. And, you know, we didn't have plastics before the 1950s. Now it's everywhere. We use it for everything. It's a great human invention because it's lightweight, it's flexible, it's basically indestructible. And that's the problem. We haven't bothered as a society. What are we going to do with all this stuff when we're done with it? And we've gone overboard. Everything, bottles, straws, shampoo bottles, tubes of toothpaste, everything's made of plastic now. Even our clothing, polyester, that's a form of plastic.
Right.
And what happens is we just throw it out.
I don't personally use any plastic. I use just glass bottles. Distill my own water, put them in glass bottles. I don't put any water into plastic. I use glass straws. If I use a straw, they're glass. I have four of them. They wash up beautifully. I don't use polyester. I use natural fibers.
Great.
And there's a lot of things that people can do personally that would help with the situation. Alrighty,
sure.
We're going to go to a 3-minute break, and we'll be right back.
Starts with you and me. Starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead. Change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you.
All right, we are back with our guest, Roman Bistrianic, and if you would like some of his chapters, excuse me, on what he's talking about, you may email him at movingbatfrommidnight@gmail.com. He doesn't have a website for these chapters yet, and hopefully that will... You will acquire one and let us know. Anyway,
you can also follow me on Twitter.
Okay.
And Instagram. It's @movingbackfrom. So I post a lot of different information there and commentary and all that kind of stuff. So
okay.
Until I get a website, well, I'm still going to use those mediums for information too. So
sure.
So yeah, so there's lots of things you can do to eliminate plastic. I'm glad you've done that. You can use bars of shampoo instead of shampoo bottles, which are great. There's a company that makes toothpaste in little pellets that come in a glass jar, and you just crunch it down and brush your teeth. It's actually, I like it a lot better than regular toothpaste. Mm-hmm. And so you've eliminated that. So it's, you know, it's a series of steps that people can take to at least get that out of the system, because you have such a huge amount being made, people don't know what to do with it. I was just watching a 60 Minutes Australia show on the plastic recycling, and it's, you know, they don't know what to do with it, so they end up burying lots of it. They end up shipping it to Malaysia, which ends up...
Good heavens.
And then what happens with it? Some of it gets broken down into pellets, but they don't have any way to control the waste, and it ends up in the oceans. And that's where we're having a huge amount of problem. Since the 1940s, we've created about 9.2 billion tons of plastic, and 6.9 billion tons of it has become waste, because only 9% has been recycled. So you have about 6.3 billion tons of this stuff in landfills and in the environment, which is equal to over 17,000 Empire State Buildings. So there's a huge amount of this stuff out there. And a lot of it ends up in the oceans. And by 2025, which is just a few years from now, there will be an estimated 100 to 250 million metric tons of plastic in the oceans, which is about 300 to 750 times the weight of the Empire State Building floating in the ocean.
Well, I remember as a child, I don't recall seeing a lot of plastic, if any at all. And I was thinking during the break I thought a lot about this before, but what we used to do with waste, and there wasn't as much waste. We purchased things, we used it up, we composted.
Right.
And we also had individual incinerators where you could burn things, but really there didn't seem to be the waste and the consumerism when I was growing up.
Sure, sure. Yeah, it's gotten a lot worse, and everything's been made for convenience and disposal, and that's been the push. It's been the mantra. And so you have a million plastic bottles being bought around the world every minute.
Oh, gosh.
480 billion plastic bottles were sold in 2016, and it's only increasing. Coca-Cola alone produces 110 billion plastic bottles every year, which is equal to almost 3,500 per second.
Wow. So now, they used to bottle their garbage in glass.
Yeah, well, I would recommend not drinking Coke at all, but if you're going to drink...
I don't drink any soda at all.
Right. But so you should drink it out of glass.
It used to be out of glass.
Sure.
I only drink water, but, gosh.
Yeah, again, I think that people should give up that kind of stuff. Where appropriate, get a water filter of some type, and then, you know, have water and make teas. You can make your own juices, all that kind of stuff, that you get away from... Well, gee, I can get that in a plastic bottle, my soda, my water, all this kind of stuff. You know, that needs to stop.
Right. Well, I make my soda out of, I make hibiscus tea. I flavor it with honey. I put it in my soda stream, and you have a kind of a fizzly little drink that's really great. And I put it in my glass bottle.
Great. So you're doing a lot of the right stuff. That's excellent. You can make juices. You get a juicer, and you can put in whatever you want, apples and carrots. They're delicious.
Yeah.
Far better than Coca-Cola.
Oh, that stuff is awful. Terrible. Okay, we're going to a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest is Roman Bistrionic, and he is talking about a lot of really cheerful things that should make us all really happy.
I'm really popular at parties these days.
This needs to be addressed. Absolutely, and I'm glad you're doing it.
This is really apocalyptic, really. You have 500 billion to 1 trillion plastic bags used every year, which is equal to 32,000 plastic bags per second, and only 1 in 200 is recycled, so the rest just goes, you pick up, you know, you will get your stuff at the grocery store, put it in a plastic bag, and you throw it out. It just keeps on accumulating. This stuff does not break down. It takes hundreds of years to break down. You have things like these K-cups for the Keurig single server coffee machine, they're made of plastic. And there was enough of those in 2014 to circle the Earth 10 times. Cigarette butts, those are made from a form of plastic, and they take decades to decompose. And it's 5.6 trillion cigarettes, or over 750,000 metric tons of butts end up in the environment or across the world every year. That's just more junk. We just keep on flooding the environment with junk, thinking it's just one giant garbage can. And right now, there's an estimated 51 trillion pieces of microplastic floating in the oceans. The oceans are turning into a plastic soup. And it's only getting worse. It's not getting better. And scientists are finding plastic everywhere, including the Arctic Ocean, where they found in 2013, 300 billion pieces of floating plastic. They're finding it in the deepest parts of the ocean, the Marianas Trench, where when they examined creatures at the bottom there, that 100% of them had plastic in them. In the big islands of Hawaii, as much on some beaches, 15% of the sand is actually grains of microplastic. It's everywhere. It's already everywhere. And, you know, it's escalating. It's not being tackled. There are some people, some places banning plastics, but it is accelerating plastic production and plastic usage and plastic pollution. And it's devastating life in the oceans, and everything from seabirds, sea snakes, turtles, sea otters, fish, crustaceans, mammals, they're being impacted, and some of them choke on the bags, they become entangled.
Of course.
And, you know, once it gets into their digestive system, it blocks it, and, you know, they're animals, they don't understand that they ate plastic. They don't know, you know, it looks the same to them. They're just, you know, gobbling it up. And it causes them to starve to death. So you have this product that, you know, we just kind of mindlessly throw away, which I used to do. I didn't think about it. But, you know, that is impacting life in the oceans. In 1960, plastic was found in like 5% of seabirds.
Huh.
And by 1980, it was 80%. 2015, it was 90%, and by 2050, they'll all have plastic. So we have all our seabirds eating plastic, and of course, some of them are going to die. They're certainly not going to be healthy. And so even right now, you have a million seabirds, 100,000 sea mammals, and an unknown number of fish, countless, being killed because of plastic pollution. And you may have seen in the, you know, articles in the news, whales washing up on shore.
Right.
And there was one in the Philippines that washed up, and it was crammed with 88 pounds of plastic garbage.
Oh.
And so you have all these beautiful creatures that are being killed by all this stuff, ending up in the ocean. And it's not just our consumer product. You know, back to the, you know, fishing, the fishing nets and lines are used to be made out of hemp and materials that would break down.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're made from, well, of course, plastic, because it's super durable. It doesn't break. But then if it's lost, it just starts, you know, inadvertently catching sea life. And they have a term for that. It's called ghost fishing. And so you have these nets floating around catching sea life and killing it. And every year, hundreds of miles of nets and lines, estimated at 640,000 tons, is lost in the ocean every year. And that's equal to 5,000 blue whales in weight. So the losing tons and tons of this stuff, along with all the plastic bags and bottles and products, it's all over the place. And it accumulates in these giant whirlpools. There's five of them. And half of the whirlpool weight is this fishing gear. And it's, again, it's killing tons and tons of sea life. And it doesn't just stay there either. Plastic doesn't decompose. It's not natural. And so what happens is it slowly breaks apart into microplastics. And this could take decades or even centuries. And then the small pieces are eaten by creatures as well, even further down the food chain, and it ends up in our food chain. It's also, the microplastics aren't just these benign little pieces of plastic either. They tend to pick up pollutants like PCBs and DDE, which is a breakdown of DDT, which is still being used on the planet for some reason. And so when they looked at plastic, because it has little nooks and crannies, it has had 100,000 to a million times the levels of PCBs on the surface of the plastic than there is in the seawater. So it's a pollution magnifier. And it's already in many species of fish, swordfish and tuna, mussels and oysters. And when they went to look that, in one study they were looking in Britain, and they found that people eating seafood eating plastic is common and widespread. And so they're finding, you know, this stuff, again, everywhere. It's in 90% of table salt. It's in 83% of world's tap water is contaminated with plastic. And 93% of bottled water is contaminated with plastic. Through salt alone, the average adult consumes approximately 2,000 microplastics per year. So it's a global catastrophe, and it's starting to get some attention.
From who?
There's more and more articles in the media about that. There's plastic bans coming into effect here and there. It's not really talked about, as far as I know, on the television much. But at least it's in various publications, and, you know, people are more and more aware of it. But it's the response is not proportional to the problem.
Right.
And the problem is that production of plastic doubles every 11 years. And with 8 million metric tons of plastic entering the ocean, is equal to one garbage truck full of plastic being dumped in the ocean every minute.
Oh, gosh.
And that's projected to increase to 4 garbage trucks of plastic every minute. So if that continues business as usual, and this is, you know, the projections show that it is. So far, we're talking about by 2050 having 850 million metric tons of plastic in the ocean, which is equal to 2,500 Empire State Buildings of plastic.
Well, there are whole industries that do nothing but create plastic.
Sure.
We were talking about plastic bags, and now I can't foresee any time in the future where these corporations are going to say, you know what, we really don't need to keep making this money, and we should do away with this product. And what would happen? What would occur if people would be more responsible, or if corporations would be more responsible? And if people asking for the product.
Right. I mean, if people, you know, stop using it in great mass numbers, then there would be a shift. I'm not saying personal responsibility is going to take care of the whole problem, but it's a start. And I think that we all can do, our individual thing to make a small difference. If you and I and a few other people do it, it's not going to do anything. Right.
No.
But it gives, you know, it creates a societal impetus for these corporations to, you know, change and provide other products, for example, like cloth bags instead of plastic bags that they could sell, and then you could reuse over and over again. And,
right.
But, you know, it's a giant problem, and until we kind of face up to this kind of issue seriously, then we're going to be in serious trouble. And it's not just the plastic destroying our whole ocean ecosystem, which could accelerate that predicted overfishing by 2050 fish collapse. I think it could accelerate it because now we're killing all the fish and other animals with plastic too. So it could even be earlier than that.
Right.
The other thing is, you know, the plastic isn't, you know, magically made. It's made out of petroleum. So more and more of our oil and is being used to make plastic. And really, I think it's by 2050, 1 out of 5 barrels of oil will be used to make plastic. Mm-hmm. And once the plastic's out in the environment, it's slowly emitting, you know, methane and ethylene. So it's not just sitting there breaking apart. It's also emitting these greenhouse gases. And this disaster alone is, Dr. Lisa Svensson of the, Director of Ocean at UN Environment said, plastics are ruining the ecosystem of the ocean in nothing short of a planetary catastrophe. Another gentleman, Eric Solheim, you know, stated as we're facing a ocean Armageddon. And I have to agree, after reading tons and tons of reports on all this, if you forget about everything else and you just thought about plastic, plastic has the ability to collapse life on the planet. Because if you kill life in all the oceans by completely contaminating it and contaminating the entire food web, where are you going to be?
Right.
And that's not taking into account anything else. So one disaster alone is horrible. And then now we combine it with overfishing, which I was saying earlier is, you know, escalating. You have these massive trawlers going around the planet, scooping up everything. And they're made into fish pellets for chicken feed, or used for farm fish.
Right,
or,
which is,
yeah,
so, they feed these farm fish, which I wouldn't eat. Terrible, terrible things. I don't eat a lot of fish, but
I suggest everyone go to zero.
Yeah.
You know, it's, our oceans are in serious trouble, to say the least. So these, you know, people are going around scooping up everything. You know, and they're decimating things like sharks. And it's estimated, I think it's between 63 to 273 million sharks are killed each year.
Oh my gosh.
That's 120 to 520 sharks killed per minute. We're just ravaging the ocean. The ocean, white tip shark has declined population wise in 50 years by 99%. It's now an endangered.
Oh my gosh.
And a lot of this is for making things like shark fin soup, which is, you know, this delicacy that has to, and these things have to stop.
Absolutely. Of course. And killing an elephant just to get at its tusks and,
oh, yeah,
and all the other nonsensical things that people do.
Oh, yeah.
It's just atrocious.
We haven't got the species extinction yet. That's a whole nother chapter. Back to the oceans, the predatory fish in the oceans have declined by 90% in the last 50 years because of industrial fishing. You know, we humans are very clever. They used to go out in rowboats and wooden ships and catch some fish. Now we have technology so we can find any fish on the planet. We can scoop them up with massive, huge nets and just scoop up everything. And, you know, this relentless quest for more and more, is again wiping out life. One report estimated 650,000 marine mammals are killed or injured from foreign fisheries being hooked and tangled. So it's not just the fish. We're wiping those out. And because we're fishing up everything, there's a diminished food supply for all the seabirds, which,
right,
they're collapsing.
Right.
Since the 70s and 80s, nearly 50% of terns and frigate birds and 25% penguins, they're gone. The longline fishing kills 160,000 to 320,000 seabirds a year. And these long lines are up to 80 miles long. And then, you know, they unintentionally trap, drown, kill seabirds, turtles, dolphins. It's just overwhelming. Since the 1950, we've fished out 6 billion metric tons of fish. And again, there's a Dr. Boris Worm who warns that this fishery decline is destroying the whole marine biodiversity. And so he's, you know, they mapped out and predicted that, at the present rate, species will vanish, marine ecosystems will unravel, and there will be a global collapse of all species currently fished. Possibly by mid-century. So in other words, by 2050, life in the oceans as we know it could collapse.
Okay, we're going to a quick break. We will be right back. Alrighty, welcome back. This is Deanna. Typed in the chat room, this is so depressing, and it is, because it makes me feel so helpless, even though I'm attempting in my own small way to mitigate the any damage that I might be doing by my lifestyle. It's still very depressing to know that it is in such a huge amount, and anybody loves nature.
If you're not depressed and upset, then you're not paying attention. I don't like making people depressed or upset, but this is the reality. And if we don't act, we're going to be in serious trouble. We're already in serious trouble. So the plastic in the ocean's already there. It's already killing sea life. It's not going to magically disappear. No one's going to scoop up the plastic. Not going to happen. It's only going to continue to break. All we can do is mitigate the damage. We need to stop putting more plastic into the environment. Period. So,
all right, so in addition to taking personal responsibility for better choices, what can we do to get others, other than have them listen to people like you, to get others to recognize the issue, the problem? How do we get the corporations, other than stop buying their garbage, how do we get them to be responsible?
Well, yeah, so that's not an easy nut to crack, right? So, the best thing I find is, you know, sharing information like this with other people. So I do that on Twitter and whatnot. And there's more and more people becoming aware. And, you know, there are drives for just plastic alone is to get people to stop using it and ban it. And in my personal opinion, I would ban plastic bottles, bags, and straws right away, which
would
get a lot of people upset because they're so used to convenience. We've been led to believe that our happiness is composed of convenient junk that we can buy. And that actually doesn't even really work. The more stuff you buy, the more you clutter up, it actually increases your anxiety and depression. And if you, you know, stop that, you have more time to spend with your family and your friends and less time at working to buy the stuff that you really don't need. And so you actually end up being happier by doing that. But, you know, so it's a giant problem. And, you know, once you're aware of it, you can, you know, do whatever you can. I don't know all the answers to how we tackle Coca-Cola producing all these bottles. I mean, we just don't need that product at all. But if you were getting it, get it in a glass bottle. And I think the more people that buy it that way, they'll go, oh, okay, we'll make more of that. But there's still going to be tons of people buying it the other way. And that's the problem. It's got to stop.
And they recycle these things. So where do they put all this trash that they pick up every week?
Right. So a lot of recycling is just kind of an illusion. You put stuff in your blue bin or whatever color bin, they take it away. You think it's being recycled. Not always true. Sometimes it's just buried. Sometimes it's broken into other pieces, but we don't want to deal with it. And places like Australia don't want to deal with it. So they just export it. And they export it to countries that can't handle it in the first place. So it goes to, it used to go to China until China decided we're not going to take any more of this stuff. So they banned it. But it goes to other places like Asia.
Wow. Do you want to stay over for a few minutes in the third hour or no?
Sure, I got some time yet.
Okay, we'll open the phone lines, take questions. Be right back.
Casting Network.
All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and Roman has agreed to stay over to answer questions, and we invite you to call into the program at 800-313-9443. And just in my own lifetime, I've seen a lot of what you're talking about and have noted the changes. It used to be that the only thing that you had to wrap leftovers in was wax paper. And and now there's aluminum foil, and there's all these various types of plastic bags, and there's plastic.
Right. What you can do is if you have leftovers, put them in glass containers, snap the lid shut. Lid is made of plastic, but you can reuse it thousands of times.
Right.
You don't need to use like plastic wrap and a lot of junk.
Right.
I'd like to kind of, if we don't have any questions right now, about species extinction. Species across the planet are collapsing. For example, lions. 1950, there were probably about 400,000 in the wild. Today, there's between 23,000 and 39,000. And there's a warning they could go extinct by 2050. At the start of the 20th century, there were 100,000 tigers. Now there's around 2,000 to 3,000. It's decreased by almost 97%. giraffes in the last 30 years have fallen by 56%, from 157,000 to 69,000.
Oh, that's all?
Yeah, black rhinos used to be 850,000. That's the estimate. Today, there's only 5,000. It declined by over 99%.
And what is killing them off? The same kind of plastic and...
No, plastic's not getting them. So what's happening to African wildlife is what happened to North American wildlife.
Oh, habitat overkill.
Loss, hunting, poaching, and yeah. This same thing of using rhino horns and elephant tusks and lion bones and tiger penises for stupid, ridiculous medicines in China and Asia. And they're also hunted for bushmeat because people are desperate and they'll eat anything. And so you have this, all these different factors just threatening all these iconic forms of life that in a short period of time, they could just be in, you know, just like dinosaurs. They might be in a few, reserves. They might be in some zoos, but you know, in the wild, they could all be gone. And it's just insane. And we're really not doing a lot about it. There are brave people out there who risk their lives and people get killed. These, people that protect these wild, you know, this wildlife on reserves.
Mm-hmm.
But the huge amount of money that people make from rhino horns are worth more than gold. And they can fetch like, you know, between 25,000 and 60,000 per kilogram for these mm-hmm. rhino horns. And so you have this huge, illegal wildlife trade that's worth $23 billion. And so you have all this money being made from these rare, you know, parts of creatures or whole creatures. And, you know, it's being driven by this, you know, a lot of this idiocy that these things are health benefits. They're not. It's just this nonsense that's being pushed along, and then people think they need these things, or they just want them, or they just want to kill something. You know, oh, I want to go spend X number of dollars to go kill something. Okay. And so you can fly to some place and go shoot something, and that makes you feel better. It's all these different things are putting such stress on all these ecosystems.
Wow.
Essentially, we're taking all the life on the planet, we're replacing it with livestock, which is 60% of mammals, 36% are humans, and only 4% are wild animals. Chickens make up 70% of all birds, and only 30% are wild. We're in the middle of the sixth mass extinction. There was five other ones that decimated life because of volcanic activity, the strike of the meteors that killed the dinosaurs, and other things like that. And we're in the middle of it. And not a lot of people recognize what a disaster we're in. We talked about insects. Globally, moths and butterflies have gone down by 35% over the last 40 years.
Wow.
75% decline in flying insects in research in Germany. I remember when I was a kid, there was moths all over the place. You know,
oh,
around
yeah.
the lake.
Me too.
You know, bugs would be hitting your windshields.
Because mm-hmm.
I remember that, and you never
right.
spray like all that. I haven't seen that in years. You know, you just don't see it.
That's why you had service stations that used to come out and wash your windshields
yeah.
because of all the bugs.
I haven't scraped off a bug off my windshield in a long time. I can't even remember. There are authors that are in the scientific literature talking about biological annihilation. This is where we are. And, you know, it's obviously that's why I warn people not to listen to this if you're depressed, because now you're going to be more depressed. So, you know, we're unwinding the whole ecosystem of the planet. In science, space science, they always talk about terraforming other planets to make them Earth-like. We're de-terraforming our own planet. We're trying to make it so it's habitable for other life. We've lost our collective minds.
And I think it's our need for immediate gratification, our need to the consumerism that drives drives this. And certainly China has better answers for medical intervention than rhino tests and things like that. What kind of crazy people would believe that eating?
Well, people believe all sorts of strange things across the planet. They have throughout history. And they still do. You know, again, it's not an easy problem to solve.
Right.
Food waste alone, right? We waste huge amounts of food. There's about almost 1.8 billion people that are in trouble with food. They suffer from hunger. And we waste 2.9 trillion pounds of food every year. And it's enough food to, you know, feed the hungry twice over. And, you know, and I see people, you know, they go to a restaurant and they just throw it away. Families waste about 1/4 of their food. They throw it away.
Wow.
Because food doesn't have any real value. It's like, oh, I can go buy that. I can buy this. I can buy that. So the affluent people, you know, from, you know, middle class on up, you know, it's just some, just food. I just bought food. I can buy food anytime I want. I can go to the grocery store, buy anything I want. So it doesn't have any real value.
When I was growing up and, I had to finish everything on my plate, and my mother informed me that there were people starving in China, and so of course I cleaned my plate. We didn't throw things away.
I did the same. My mom came over, my parents came over during World War II through Europe, and so I heard the stories of not having enough food to eat, eating food with bugs.
Mm-hmm.
So you had enough food to eat, and I watched things like The World at War and these kind of other things when I was a kid. And, you know, I grew up with some kind of appreciation, and I don't think a lot of people have that. So they're, you know, it's this whole mentality of, well, I earned it, I can buy it, therefore that's all I need to worry about. You know, as if the whole world is just based on money, which is, you know, artificial construct in the first place. And the same thing goes for clothes. Fast fashion has taken over quality clothes. It's this, I can buy a t-shirt for $5. Well, I didn't wear it. I can just throw it away. And it's a huge resource waste. And the United States imports around 97% of their clothes. And, you know, that's crazy. You can make quality clothes here instead of shipping it. And the reason we do it is because, honestly, we have slave labor in other countries.
Right.
We have people in Bangladesh who work for a couple bucks a day, working in horrible factories in horrible conditions, and no environmental laws, so they can just dump all the waste into the rivers, which ends up, in the oceans. So we can get $5 shirts from H&M and these other places. It's a collective insanity. We just, you know, because we want cheap junk, we're allowing the destruction of the planet. And it's, you know, it's going to come back and bite us and really badly.
And of course the technology too. We have a lot of technology that is very dangerous for the environment. Mm-hmm. There's cell towers all over. There are just, G5, there are all kinds of things that we didn't have in the environment a long time ago or a few years ago that really do make a difference. I don't have a smart meter on my home. I have a sign that says do not remove this analog meter. But these things are dangerous. To the insects, the birds, people don't know, what the impact of all this technology has on the environment.
Sure. Yeah, so, yeah, everyone buys the latest gadget. They get the latest TV. Even if their TV is okay, they can just throw it out. It's not that much money. Oh, whatever. You know, I'll just buy a new one. You know, and all that stuff goes somewhere. It doesn't get reused. So you have the equivalent of like 800 laptops thrown out every second.
Oh, you're kidding. And where do they throw them out at? Because they
end up in the dump. A lot of it gets exported to, again, China or other Asian countries where poor people, you know, sit there with some fire and try to melt off and, you know, capture back things like, you know, copper and things like that. And they release huge amounts of toxins, which are, of course, destructive to them and destructive to the environment. And to, you know, the average person, it's like, oh, I just threw it out. I bought a new one. There's no responsibility for the end use of any of this stuff. So it's a broken system. You can buy whatever you want. You just throw it away. And there's no expectation that you have to do much. Except, well, maybe I threw my bottle in the recycle bin, which probably isn't even being recycled.
Wow.
Depressingly enough.
When I was in China in 2007, you could not breathe in Beijing. And most of the local residents wore face masks.
Sure.
You literally could not breathe. And when we were going down the Yangtze River, you could smell gasoline. And you could see it floating on top of the river.
So all the rivers are polluted and essentially dead. There's a river in Indonesia, the Sitrum River, Sitrum, I think it's called. It's loaded with, you can find documentaries on YouTube. It's filled with dyes and plastic and human refuse. There's 200 textile factories along the river, and they just dump their dyes into the river.
Okay, we do have some callers. I got two minutes, sorry. Oh, my gosh. Okay. Let's take Bill in Austin. Bill?
Hello. Great show.
Hey. Yes. Wonderful.
Couple of quick questions. There was an old saying the Indians used to have that never live downstream of the white man. So I think that kind of holds true today to some degree.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, on your first hour, you spoke of the environmental pollution that people lived in 1800s, the raw sewage and different health concerns. Does it seem to you that we're doing somewhat similar to the environment now, only in a more modern fashion? We're polluting in a similar way?
Oh, sure. We're just essentially better hiding it in the Western world, thinking that, you know, we got relatively clean air and we're doing, you know, recycling and whatnot. We just export it to other parts of the world. And I think the reason China has done so well is because the West has exported their cheap labor, and, you know, lack of pollution laws over there. We exported it all. So that's why there's this brown haze is over lots of Asia, because we wanted cheap labor and no environmental standards, and that's happened over, you know, many decades. So, yeah, if you go out to those countries, those rivers are polluted worse probably than we had in the 1800s, because now they're filled with all sorts of chemicals that never existed in the 1800s.
The second question is, are you trying to start a movement, or are you just more interested in just disseminating your material that you compile?
My interest is to change, you know, a lot of people. Yes, it's more, there are people in, you know, so-called environmental movement. Yeah, so that's the main goal. The information I'm disseminating is to get people to change. It's not just, oh, here's some interesting, you know, type of interesting stuff to read, you know, oh, okay, great. No, it's to make changes, to try to have an impact. And honestly, the damage and the momentum of the damage is massive. So it's already underway. there's not much you can do to mitigate that damage, these collapses from happening. But if you don't do anything, it's just only going to be worse.
Have you done any research on the Fukushima disaster and also
No.
the Chernobyl in Russia, where there are no humans allowed back in the area, and then nature started rebuilding itself?
Yeah, well, I have a possible chapter on that, but I haven't really done that. I think I'm going to probably drop that particular. I have too much to possibly get done, so I might add that later anyway. I don't really know. Right now I'm kind of covering plastics in the ocean, the overfishing, coral reefs collapsing, which we didn't talk about, ocean dead zones, glaciers vanishing, tropical rainforests collapsing. So all these kind of things, species extinction. That's probably going to be enough. That's depressing enough.
We appreciate all your research that you do very much. Thank you for answering the questions.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you. Follow me on Twitter, moving back from, and or Instagram. And, I'll be happy to send out the chapters. So just email me at movingbackfrommidnight@gmail.com.
We got to get your website up dedicated to this.
If you'd like to help me, that'd be great. I've been trying to get that sort of going, but I haven't succeeded.
I have a friend that is a genius at doing that.
Let me know.
Refer you. Okay, we have another caller, Jenna in Washington.
Okay, I got two more minutes, but yeah.
Okay, Jenna, go ahead.
Great. I really like that you brought up your research back in the 1800s in London, because it reminded me that there was a soil scientist that was actually applying charcoal, which is a topic that I'm very interested in rejuvenating the soil, recarbonizing the soil, because that's less understood among the populace of what's going on with the planet, because the soil is so depleted of carbon. So I've been making biochar and researching about biochar, but I couldn't find the name of the scientist that like went into a workhouse and just dumped in a whole bunch of charcoal, and it removed the smell because it adsorbs. And then it reminded me of the Terra Preta story in the Amazon. In the 1500s, the sanitation system was utilizing the charcoal to actually create humus with the human waste. And it just jarred all of these thoughts that I find that are applicable.
That's really interesting. Can you email me some of that?
I would love to.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Right.
I have to go. I appreciate the time. I'd like
to
come back on again.
Bless your heart for what you're doing.
Starts with you and me. Starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me.
All righty, we are back, and I thank our guest for the information that he gave, and the phone lines are open. If you have some comments about what we learned today, if you have any, well, comments about anything. It doesn't have to be regarding what we talked about in the first part of the program. After 8 years of use, my desktop computer, which I was 8 years old, 8.5 years old. It just literally gave up the ghost. And, so I did reluctantly replace it. Had to get used to Windows 10 because it had Windows 7 on it. I had to get used to MS Word 365. And, so it's been a very educational week for me. I've also been doing some other things that are very interesting. But this recycling thing and the the decimation of the planet and just the things that I have noticed. And I do love to be outside. I used to do a lot of gardening, organic gardening, and I composted everything. As I was growing up, we didn't have all of the plastic and all of the other stuff that permeates our entire environment. And we don't really realize just what kind of damage that we are doing. And I did replace all of my plastic containers and that sort of thing with glass throughout any aluminum cookware that I had. Well, yeah, I wonder where it went. Gosh. Yeah. I recycled it. Threw it in the garbage. And where did it go? I don't know. I do try and make my own products, shampoo and toothpaste and that kind of thing. And we can each do whatever we can do in our own homes to try to live healthier and to keep from adding to the problem. But of course it happens incrementally. If all of this stuff had all of a sudden descended upon us in a very short period of time, of course we would have rebelled. We would have said something about it. But incrementally, we accept, for instance, as the telephones begin to change. And I think I was probably one of the first people in my immediate circle that got a mobile phone. It was a Motorola phone. It was big, really big. And I was on the road at the time doing a lot of traveling, and I just felt that I really needed to have a phone that was readily accessible so that I could call home or somebody could get a hold of me. But it had it was huge, and it had a cradle where you could recharge it and everything, and I was so proud of that phone. And of course, now I do have a cell phone that I do not use. I use it maybe once or twice a month, only for emergencies and I try to get rid of all the electrical product in my bedroom so that I am not getting zapped with dirty electricity. I have Graham Stetzer filters on many of my outlets. I have gadgets that I try to limit the bad frequencies that come into the home. I think we can each do as much as we possibly can to eliminate what we would refer to as modern technology. But I love having Roman on the program. He's always a wealth of information, was a wealth of information regarding vaccines. If you have any questions or comments about vaccines or anything at all that you want to call into the program about, then please feel free. And of course, the number is 800-313-9443. And, it's kind of a depressing thing. But anyway, we will be right back.
Thoughts with you and me. Starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead. Change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts
righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and we're talking about some of the things that we could be doing in order to keep from destroying the planet. Okay, let's take Lark in Texas. Lark, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Deanna.
Hi. It's lovely to hear your voice and to have you call in.
Well, thank you. Great show as usual.
Thank you.
I was very interested in Roman's remarks. First of all, I want to say that I think we need to be cautious about being herded into accepting this so-called Green New Deal or anything like it.
Oh.
Mother Gaia worship and all this other stuff.
Yes.
This all comes out of the Club of Rome and a document called Limits to Growth. It's how they intend to make the whole world a communitarian world. And so we need to be cautious about being driven like a herd of bison to the end, to the edge of a cliff, so
mm-hmm.
that we can make food for the Amerindians over the winter.
Right.
So what I want to say is, I know that, you know, I'm in my mid-60s, and I remember when I was young, I used to think about these things long and hard, because, of course, the first Earth Day was commemorated on my mother's birthday. That would have been April 22nd, 1970.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that was in celebration of Vladimir Lenin's birthday, which occurred 100 years earlier.
Oh, yeah.
That would have been April 22nd, 1870. So,
yes.
The thing that I've learned about history, since we weren't really taught history as we were growing up, is number one, these wars are just not what we thought they were. And that includes the Revolutionary War.
Oh, absolutely.
But, you know, the formal document, the treaty, which ended those hostilities, on the American soil was called the Treaty of Paris.
Mm-hmm.
In the Treaty of Paris, it was the colonists who were paying reparations to the crown.
Mm-hmm.
Not the other way around. So when you look at that, if you look at the language of that document and you really parse it, you realize who actually won that war. And it wasn't the American people. Remember, the U.S. Constitution didn't come about until later.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
And it was written by the elite for the elite.
That's right.
The Articles of Confederation were really more for the people. And it was more for states' rights and that kind of thing. And,
yeah, most of the vast majority of the American colonists were people that were trying to escape the turmoil, of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were, simple people. They were farmers, craftsmen and tradesmen and so forth and so on. And, you know, they probably wanted to get along.
Mm-hmm.
With the existing indigenous populations. But the truth is that the crown never relinquished under international law their territorial claim upon this land under the right of conquest and the law of discovery.
Right.
And that means that the average American today has never been conferred allodial property rights. Now remember, the property was a very important thing to the colonists, because they didn't have property rights in England and other parts of Europe, because basically they were coming out of the feudal system. It was a very torturous time. But here's the thing. If people actually had allodial property rights, then imagine if you have 4 to 5 acre tracts of land on one side of a river, and you have 4 or 5 acres of 5 acre tracts on the other side of the river, and there were 20 homesteading families, or excuse me, 8 homesteading families on either side of the river total, then you could not pollute another one's space without some remedy in under common law to stop the degradation. In other words, you wouldn't want to pollute your own river, especially if you derive sustenance from that river. Maybe you fish that river. And so today, the truth is that we don't have a government of, by, and for the people at all. What we have is, I mean, the largest polluting entities in America today are really the energy companies, the U.S. military, the telecom industry.
You're right.
The pharmaceutical industry. And these people are all protected. And so we're being poisoned by people who are essentially being protected. And the people that are the sock puppets that supposedly represent the people and their go-betweens between big industries and the environmental protection of the people do not exist. We no longer have a representative government.
If we ever did at all.
That's right. And so I just wanted to say that, you know, when I was a boy, Deanna, I thought there was something wrong with skyscrapers. There was just something wrong about that. I remember I knew a lot of hippies and free thinkers naturally growing up, just like probably you did. Other people our age did. And I remember this one pretty well-read girl. She described skyscrapers as big penises in the sky.
You know, the pillars typically are representative of what you just said. And I grew up in Sacramento. We moved from Nevada to Sacramento, and Sacramento was not really, they didn't have a lot of skyscrapers. But buildings do represent, certain bodily parts. And always have, since very ancient times. So yes, I recall that, that is one of the things that, what you just said.
Well, the fact is, you know, if Americans actually had allodial property rights, this kind of, environmental degradation could not have happened.
Right.
It could not have happened. Because people just wouldn't stand for it. I mean, nobody wants the air they breathe, the water they drink, and the land upon which they trod, the food they eat, to be poisoned. And yet we countenance this. And we've got people that are in these particular industries and do not realize, because they're compartmentalized, that they're actually involved in organized crime.
You're right.
The
and
US
of course, Congress
is the world's greatest polluter.
Which is? Who is?
The U.S. military is the world's greatest polluter.
You're absolutely right. They bury on every base, or if they relinquish land, it's always incredibly polluted and can't be used for anything else. But they do use it for other things. And you're right. That look at all the bombs and all the destruction that they have, all over the planet, actually.
Well, you know, Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth, Indiana, you know, they closed that base down. You know, remember there was a spate of base closings, military base closings across the country.
Right.
Well, the place was so polluted that, you know, could have qualified for Superfunding. Or Superfund sites, you know, for cleaning it up. But instead, they build a prison.
Oh, my gosh. Oh,
my
gosh.
And the United States has, we have the largest prison population in the world.
Right.
Per capita, right here in America. So how is it different from the time of Alexander Solzhenitsyn and when he wrote about the Gulag Archipelago?
Right.
Anyway. That's the answer, and that could be explored in depth anytime. It's about allodial property rights, and that's the only thing that's going to reverse it. It's the only thing, and it has to be enshrined in the law, Because the truth is the wealth, the real wealth in this life is our attachment to the land.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where health and well-being is derived.
How
true.
You can
also talk about the plumbing system, too. You know, the plumbing system has been all wrong. This idea of flushing our waste, and mixing it into the water system, it was all wrong. It has to be completely rethought, and people have rethought it. They've come up with solutions. I mean, I'm not one to say that I'm against modern plumbing, but the idea of, you know, Wynn Parker used to talk about these things,
mm-hmm.
although I didn't cotton to his solution.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and we have to be careful about being, you know, railroaded or herded, to basically, you know, we live in a modern world, and if we're forced to live like they did back in the 18th century again, it's going to kill a lot of people, which of course I think is part of the agenda is depopulation. And mm-hmm. it seems pretty evident, I think, to most folks by now.
Right. And you're right. The industries that you mentioned, really, they are able to act in incredibly irresponsible ways simply because of the lobbyists that they have in Congress. And Congress really are a bunch of criminals, and you appealing to the government is not going to make any difference at all, because
these people are not your friend. And you know, the fact of the matter is this: the entire European settlement of the Americas, the master plan was conceived by Francis Bacon in his New Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really all about piracy and slavery. And, you know, there's something that you can watch. You know, white slavery really did exist.
Oh, it was more popular than black slavery. Absolutely. You're right.
We've entered into a time of actual technological slavery. I call it techno-slavery. And remember, you know, slavery always begins in the mind. And when we tie that back to what occurred in 1863 with during the war between the states, you know, you had an international lawyer from Harvard College who was a conscript in the Union Army as a major, and his name was Franz Lieber.
Right,
Francis
the Lieber Code.
Anglicized. Mm-hmm. And that has never been rescinded. It placed all Americans
right.
under martial rule, and it was called the Doctrine of Necessity. The
mm-hmm.
only thing that mattered was the free flow of capital and commerce.
Right.
And whatever it took to keep the peace. And so basically it's been all about plunder of the resources of this land. And it was under Teddy Roosevelt that this country implemented British imperial land use policies.
Right.
Because the fact is, we never escaped from England. We never escaped from the clutches of the crown. And that's evidenced by the fact that we had a Barbados Caribbean slave trader named Levine, who was George Washington's first Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton. He was tied to the Bank of England, and just like Martha Custis, she was a widow woman when she married George Washington, and she had her family, she inherited a sizable number of shares also in the Bank of England. So we go back to the true history of this country, you know, when we talk about the British East India Company and so forth. Basically, what we have is one big commercial enterprise. And it's run by corporations who, you know, their only reason for existence is so that they can have liability protection.
Right. Right. And that came with right after the so-called Civil War. And I've written a lot about this in my trilogy, But thank you for bringing this all up. And, wow. How true.
We talk about communitarian systems today. Basically that's supposed to be the synthesis of the thesis, capitalism, versus the antithesis of communism. But see, capitalism and communism are both socialist constructs, and they're both Jewish constructs. So how could communitarianism be a suitable answer?
Right.
For a new system of government, and especially in a time when we've got this instant communication. You know, it's the greatest surveillance and espionage tool ever devised, this modern technology.
Capitalism was called the European plan, and it was created by the communists. It's the same.
There you go.
It's the same thing.
Thanks for letting me weigh in, Deanna.
Oh, thank you for weighing in. I always love to hear from you. We need to have you back on the show, on the program, as a guest. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
I'd be glad at any time.
You're always so wise. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All righty. Take care. We have Brian in Washington. Brian, welcome.
Hello. So, yeah, I like what Lark had to say. I, too, am taking Jerry Perry's advice in that six-page article she wrote in the last month. I think it's called Word to the Wise, Beware the Green New Deal.
Right. I need to email her and get her on the program also. She's got a lot of good things to say. Could you hang on over the break? We'll be right back.
Yes.
Okay. You're right back. All righty. We are back. And we're talking with Brian in Washington. So, where'd we leave off?
Well, the Green New Deal and
right.
Look out.
Okay.
And, of course, I also concur with Lark. We messed around and made mistakes from the get-go with this mixing our waste into the water and dumping it in the sea, the rivers. I'm kind of thinking if you took a butter knife and spread our population thinly, we could all deal with our own waste, and that way it wouldn't be contaminated with large building areas. We really do have a big threat with these smart cities. We do have a huge mm-hmm. threat to rural existence.
Right.
This really would be something worth focusing on. They have come up with solutions that are causing all these problems, and we need a way out of it, and that might just be the key that unlocks the door. Let's see. I think that Tony Pantelaresco, so here's Jerry Perry, Larkin, Texas. Tony Pantelaresco, Deanna knows all these people. Surprise, surprise. He says, you know, Washington State has got a new law. They're going to legally be able to compost humans. And Tony is saying,
what?
Yeah. So, you know, cremation and burials in a cemetery is expensive, Deanna. We need to be able to fire up a bulldozer and just push all these dead bodies, perfectly legal, into a pit and call it compost. That's what Tony is kind of figuring out. This is where we're going, mass kill off, slow kill. So Yeah, I wanted to mention some of that. And, you know, if you're going to chat with Lark, you could have Jerry on at the same time.
Oh, yes, that would be a great program.
Because, you know, in her article, she mentioned communitarianism, but of course, along with Rosa Corey, the so-called guru that is not somebody I want to believe everything that Rosa Corey says. She's kind of got her feet in the fire. She's involved with this whole land takeover, and now she's our new leader of holding the banner with the communitarian information she gleaned from Nikki. So,
all right.
If you were to have Jerry on, who doesn't really feel like she's God's gift to the radio airwaves,
oh,
rather
she's
read
she's
things.
A wonderful person.
Well, Lark could be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'm going to have Jenna put up this Word to the Wise article on the chat, along with a German guy and his Terra Preta biochar sanitation. He is spelling it out to college students, saying, I was told the same thing when I was a kid in college when I raised my hand. What about all the nutrient in waste that
right.
we're putting down the toilet? He said, it's the same people pushing climate change that was answering my question with, next question, please. I don't want to talk about it. Thank you, Deanna.
Wow. Thank you, Brian. And thank you, listeners. I think we've been well fed today by both our guests and our callers. So thank you very much, and we will visit next week. Thank you. Have a wonderful week.